Good morning. We're ready for the first case, Aliota against National Railroad Passenger Corporation. Mr. Bale?
Your Honors, Counsel, I'm Jim Vale for the plaintiff. This is a death case, a passenger standing on a railroad platform awaiting the approach of an Amtrak train was drawn into the side and killed. The railroad claimed that the decedent, the passenger, had stepped off the platform directly in front of the train. And it was plaintiff's theory that he was standing on a dangerously narrow platform when this train went by at 78 miles an hour and was swept into its side. We were barred from presenting any evidence on being swept into the side.
But Mr. Vale, you didn't offer any fluid mechanics expert or someone who actually could have worked through the equations of the way the moment of the train was going, the weight of the passenger, the kinds of things that maybe there are actually equations that will tell you what is going to happen in a situation like that.
No, Judge, what we did is we used what we thought was the best witness, the risk manager of their own railroad, someone who has been investigating hundreds of accidents, railroad accidents, someone who has spent 12 years as a risk manager who was overseeing public and employee safety, who in his deposition under oath said that any train going 78 miles an hour will create a vacuum and that anyone, including employees or passengers, who are within a few feet of that train will be swept into its side.
The problem is he wasn't an expert, and did you lay out what his qualifications were other than his experience?
Those were his qualifications, Your Honor, his experience as a risk manager.
Yeah, but you needed some expert testimony here to deal with the mechanics of why that occurs. You didn't have an eyeball witness. No witness saw it, you know, so the gaping hole is his qualifications and the fact that there's no expert witness.
Well, there were two eyewitnesses.
Yeah, but they didn't see what happened.
They were in a position that they could see whether he was hit by the front of the train, and both said he wasn't, which confirmed our theory that he was on the other side of this train as it went by, and then once he was gone after it went by, he had to have been swept into it. And the risk manager
manager, you didn't even put forth his qualifications other than his experience, like any training that he had about the effect of the speed and the fact that this vacuum would occur. There was no training that you put forth that he had. There was no testimony to that effect, right?
No, other than his experience.
And he tried to get this in as an admission as well. But one problem I have is I don't think you didn't establish very clearly exactly what this man's responsibilities were, whether he's a decision maker, whether he made recommendations as to responsibility for accidents. He investigated a lot of accidents, but we don't know what happened after that.
Other than the fact that he testified that he was in charge of public and employee safety.
Well, did he
What does that mean, though, specifically?
Well, risk, the term itself, risk manager. What does risk mean?
It doesn't mean anything to me. I mean, I got to know specifically how responsible a job this is. I don't know what.
The trial judge apparently demoted him from risk manager to stenographer.
Well, here's an example. Did he file any reports with the company offering conclusions about the cause of the accident? Does the company rely on him once he gives some conclusion as to what occurred? Does the company rely in some way on the conclusion that he reaches?
No.
Did he reach conclusions as to the cause of other accidents and report those to the company?
I assume he has.
But there's no testimony. Yeah, but there's no testimony of that effect
well,
in the record.
Well, no, the testimony is, I guess, 12 years investigating hundreds of railroad accidents. I thought that was sufficient to infer that the man was an expert in railroad accidents. And, you know,
he might be an expert in railroad accidents, but the problem is your specific theory is this vacuum that he thought would be created. But that's a sophisticated question of fluid mechanics, and vacuums may be created at different distances depending on the size of the object, the way the air is going to flow, and lots of other things, whereas he might have been making the common sense statement, if you're standing 2 feet away from a train that's whizzing by, you might lose your balance, you might, you know, in other ways be threatened. Maybe there's something protruding from the train that could hit you. He might, as a matter of common sense, have all sorts of good reasons to say don't stand that close to the train. But your exact theory, I think, just doesn't come out from his expertise.
Well, you know, he was offered not as an expert witness, but as an admission
And you have problems with the admission because is the company bound by his admissions? What's the impact of his admission? See, that's the problem there. There was no testimony on that.
The testimony was that the admission is within the scope of his employment as a risk manager investigating accidents.
Well, yeah, I understand your theory, but I'm saying in order for that to fly, he has to have some ultimate responsibility by the company as to determining the cause of accidents, and somehow the company has to use that information or rely on that information or be bound by that information in some way. We don't have anything like that in the record.
Well, other than a description of his job as risk manager,
Was this an admission? That's another question that probably was, but he did not relate this theory to this particular accident. He didn't say this accident was caused by certain conditions. He just, under questioning, he just expounded this idea that a train traveling at a high speed creates a vacuum which may suck people into it. But he didn't say that's what happened in this case, did he? I mean, he didn't really say anything that was an admission of liability in this particular situation.
Yes, but Judge, what it is, it serves notice on the defendants that they are aware that a rapidly moving train will create a danger to anyone within a few feet of the train. And our argument, one of our theories of liability, was that the platform that was provided was dangerously narrow, too narrow to permit someone to stand and await an approaching train. And in the opening statement of the defendant, he even stated that platform on which he was standing was not to be used to wait for trains.
Could I ask to what extent you thought the question whether he was a passenger or not was a question of fact or a question of law?
On the instruction.
Well, if it's a question of fact, you would instruct the jury on it. You would say you must find he's a passenger if A, B, or C. If it's a question of law, then it's something the trial court should have figured out before the jury ever started thinking about this case.
I would say that the judge, had he granted our instruction, which is based on that Katamaber's CTA case, the jury could have found him to be a passenger.
So you're telling me it's a question of fact.
It's pretty close. Well. The judge probably could have concluded that he was a passenger just reading the Katamate case, in which the Supreme Court of Illinois said that you don't have to be in the act of boarding a train to be a passenger. And in that case, simply moving toward the train. That was the one where the passenger caught her foot
Right, but you know, the problem is that your case has extra complications because, in fact, there was no train that was going to stop at this particular station in the morning. He was either misinformed or misheard or something went wrong, right, when he called to find out if he was going to get on a 7:30 train.
Yeah, tragically, when he said 7:30, they meant
tragically.
The evening. And he
does that mean that anywhere I stand by a train track with the intent myself of boarding a train, even if the train has no obligation or has never advertised it's going to stop there, I'm a passenger? Is it my subjective intent that makes me a passenger?
Well, is there any duty on the railroad, considering the risk of what a train does, to warn passengers not to stand on a platform which is clearly there as an invitation to potential passengers?
Well, would you say that at a time that no one in the world thought the train was going to be coming for passengers?
No one.
Well, 3 a.m, you know, no trains coming through whatsoever. Would you say don't stand on the platform? I just wonder how much of a duty you think the railroads have.
Well,
how it relates to scheduled stops.
Well, there's an IPI instruction stating that the railroad, a common carrier, has the duty to provide a safe platform for the boarding and getting off trains. And the trial court barred that instruction also, saying it wasn't applicable.
Right. If you want to save time, it's certainly up to you, but you're in your rebuttal time.
Oh, okay.
You'd like to save a little bit.
Anyway, we request that the verdict and judgment be vacated and remanded for a new trial. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Phoebus?
Please support Joseph Phoebus, and with me is Stephen Wright on behalf of Amtrak and the Illinois Central. I do not know if I could add anything to the court's questions concerning the vacuum theory. Clearly, there was no expert evidence as to its existence, no expert evidence as to if it did exist, that it had any effect in this case, and there's certainly no evidence that Mr. Pendergast had any qualifications that would cause what the trial judge referred to after the offer of proof, the folklore, to be an admission on the part of the railroad. There's no publication.
Why isn't it an admission?
Pardon me?
Why is it not an admission?
Well, because he does not, two reasons. As to Amtrak, he doesn't work for Amtrak, never has. As to the Illinois Central, he is not a person who meets 801-2D2, or D2D, I guess it is, because it's not within the scope of his employment as to how to operate the railroad. It's not within the scope of his employment to write rules for operation or safety. It's not within the scope of his employment in any respect. He is a person who investigates occurrences. And he even testified, as we pointed out, I believe, that his job is not to form opinions but to gather facts. There was just nothing that I could see, Your Honor, that would in any respect make him a agent for the on behalf of the Illinois Central for the purpose of admissions or testimony contrary to the railroad's interest concerning the existence of an alleged vacuum effect, which is, as the court pointed out, a complex question of fluid mechanics.
But you know what? I mean, basically his theory is that for whatever reason, standing on that little narrow island placed him in a position of unreasonable danger from passing trains, as I had said a minute ago, whether it was because something's protruding from the train or just because the wind that the train creates causes particularly an elderly man maybe to lose his balance, who knows what. And I was worried about aspects of your theory, including the fact that somehow everybody knows that you're not supposed to be standing on this platform, even though there are no signs to that effect. There's actually a wooden walkway that invites people to walk over there. not at all clear to me that as a matter of law that that is the case. And also, I'm worried about his status as a passenger, because certainly a lot turns on whether he's a passenger. And there's another Illinois decision, the Skelton case, Skelton against CTA, that seems to indicate that when a person is waiting for a train at the proper place with the intention of becoming a passenger, not physically walking to the train, that individual's a passenger. So shouldn't the trial court have decided this issue of being a passenger as a matter of law? And if he is a passenger, don't we need to have further proceedings?
I think Your Honor asked me about four questions.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm trying to remember them. As to his status
take
as a passenger.
Take them as they come, yeah.
His status as a passenger, last verse.
All right.
That starts out as a question of fact in all cases. I can rise to you can determine as a matter of law he is, or as a matter of law he isn't. I argued at the jury instruction conference as a matter of law he was not a passenger. The judge disagreed. Mr. Vail, in essence, argued he was, and the judge disagreed. I suggest that when you have someone where a train is going 78 miles an hour, you can see it for miles coming, there's no question, it's not sneaking up on him, that it's certainly a question of fact where standing on there and moving, I think there's more than just being on the platform. I think you've got to do something to manifest an intent to get on the train. Of course, the case is normally talking about moving toward the train.
But is it only the person's intent, or is there some interaction with the train schedule or something? Because I understood your position to be that he might be standing there on this platform thinking he's going to get on the train, but nobody's going to board a 78-mile-an-hour moving train.
As a matter of law, no reasonable person would believe
would
that.
Would even try. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it's impossible, right?
Yes.
So is it only the individual's intent, or does it somehow have to be a reasonable intent? Is there an objective component?
To the extent it's intent, I suggest it has to be reasonable. The Illinois pattern jury instruction on what is a passenger, I think, adequately controlled, and that was the one actually utilized by the court. And there's no reason to believe that it's not adequately stated, and it is moves toward that he's on the platform, and I don't have a copy of it with me, but it's in the brief.
Moving toward it with the intent to board or something like that.
Yes, yeah. Yes, and but the jury was instructed as to that question of fact, and I don't think you could ever say as a matter of law he was a passenger for a train coming through at 78 miles an hour. And so they were instructed on what a passenger was. As to the platform design, the defendant called an expert, a plaintiff, I'm sorry, the expert testified at length, a Professor Berg from University of Wisconsin, and gave his opinions that the platform was not safe and it should have had more signs, and the jury heard this. It was a question of a fact. Our position was, our main position was at the trial was he was more than 51% at fault, obviously. But our position was, we argued that there was a yellow line there, and there's a kiosk and a main platform, and it should be evident.
There's no yellow line on this island platform, though, is there?
No, it's on. You'd have to cross the yellow line on the main platform to get the center platform.
How about this instruction on a place to alight or a place to get on? That was refused, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Now, that seems to me to really be at the heart of this case, is was this a dangerous place to be to get on a train? So I have a hard time understanding why that would not have been a proper instruction. I mean, your claim is that just applied to taxis and buses or something, but I don't know that any Illinois court ever said that.
Well, all the cases that apply it are always in the proposition of a ad hoc stop, if you will. That instruction, they did get instructions as to that the railroad was negligent in the design of the station, in the signage at the station, in all those things. That was presented to the jury. But the question, that instruction really doesn't go to the design, I suggest, the station, but goes to the selection of where you pick up or discharge the passenger. And had the railroad stopped for some reason 2 miles out of town and told people to get up and walk to town because of whatever reason, and they tripped on...
Well, the only reason for taking that position, I guess, is there are more cases involving vehicles that don't have a fixed place to alight than there are railroad cases. But I'm not sure, I don't understand why the concept shouldn't apply here. I mean, what's the difference? You get off 2 miles, you'd probably be a lot safer trying to get on 2 miles away from the station than you would here. So.
I'd like to concede that point, but I've seen a lot of debris on the right-of-ways. But the answer, if you think of it just in the abstract, Your Honor, they claim the station design and signage was negligent in that regard, not in the maintenance of it, but in the design, signs, so on, the platform width. And that was presented to the jury. And that's just a question of negligence. It has nothing to do with where you stop the train. I mean, surely you would not say that the Amtrak crew should have stopped 300 yards before the station and waved at people, or after the station and waved at people to come there. And there's no contention that in deciding, I guess this would be the situation, there's no contention that there was negligence in the decisional process of where to locate the station. Had the railroad located the drop-off of the station under the post office on Congress Street, so people had to alight there in the median strip, then you might say, well, there was negligent selection of the location. But this is really not a location case. It's a case involving the design of the station, and they fully presented their case. They got instructions to the jury on the case, and
this was just remind me of an instruction that imposed on the railroad simply the ordinary duties of a landowner to have the station properly designed, no extra care.
Okay. That's right. Yes, and that was the defense instruction. Didn't take into consideration that Illinois Central was never a common carrier in this case, whatever else it was. So its duty was always of ordinary care, you know, in regards to the design and maintenance of the station, which was presented. Amtrak duty is ordinary care unless he is a, quote, passenger, and the IPI instruction as to passenger that's been approved by the committee, and I suggest adequately states the law, was given. So I think the court, when you look at instructions as a whole, the jury is adequately instructed. When you look at the vacuum theory, there's a total absence of probative evidence, either by way of admission or by way of expert testimony, and certainly a total absence of evidence that it was causally, if it didn't exist, that there was causation. As to where the
theory, you argued the Davis case, I guess, in support of some of your positions on instructions here, which would involve what someone going down a stairway off the platform, isn't it? I mean, that's not very close to this case. I mean, one rationale for saying a passenger should there's a greater duty of care to a passenger than anybody else is that passengers generally are in close proximity to trains. Isn't that one of the concepts behind that theory of liability? And here, this person was in too close proximity to the train.
Well, we will all agree that in one way or another, he was in too close proximity. Yes, sir. It was certainly disputed. The rail crew says he hit the front of the locomotive, right at him, and eyewitnesses with our human factors expert, we showed that they had a limited view, and matter of fact, the geometry was such that they weren't in a position to tell if he hit the front of the train or the side of the train or wherever. The fact of the matter is, Judge, that they did get instructions as to design and of the station signage, and they did present their evidences to that. I do not understand what their problem is. There was no evidence that the location of the station was somehow...
Well, I think I understand your point there.
Okay. Your Honor asked me one more question, but I can't remember what it is.
Don't worry about it.
Okay. If Your Honors have no further questions, I will sit down at this time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. We'll call.
In reference to the IPI instruction on who was the passenger that was actually given, it in effect ruled that Mr. Aliotta was not a passenger. The instruction that was given stated that a passenger is someone who is in the act of boarding. And of course, the cases, the Catamate case and the cases cited do not have that requirement. So Mr. Alioli was effectively ruled not a passenger and therefore not entitled to the highest degree of care from the common carrier.
I thought the Catamate case, though, did have some concept in it of at least taking some steps in the direction of boarding, some measures, and just standing there doesn't seem to be enough.
Well, moving, I think Katame said, moving toward the train with the intent of boarding.
Right, and how could it be said that he was doing that vis-a-vis a 70? I mean, surely, I take it the topography of this area is pretty flat, right? So you can see the trains coming. And we have to assume that a train coming at you at 78 miles an hour looks a little different than a train that's slowing down to the station.
Well, it's also evidence that he had been going up to Chicago periodically. So he was anticipating that train to stop. And there's also evidence showing that he started at one end of the platform when the train was, the light was first noticed. And even their own expert said that at that distance, you can't tell the speed. The train has to be within so many hundred feet before you can really determine the speed of an approaching object. And during that time span, his back was to the train. And he, according to the witness, and he walked northward to where that crossover was, turned, and now he's waiting for the train to stop, which I see is no different than someone walking toward the train. He turns, he's waiting for the train, and the train doesn't stop. And with our theory, he was swept into it. Which brings me to another point where we had photographs of the body,
That means you have a minute. Go ahead.
Which suggested that the injuries were not that of someone being hit head-on by a 78-mile-an-hour train.
But of course, we review things like that on abuse of discretion. The trial court said it would be far too prejudicial to let those photographs in. Not enough relevance.
And the only prejudicial was to the railroad because it supported our theory. And then, when the court gave the instruction on duty to avoid an approaching train or crossing tracks, tripling up on plaintiff's duty of ordinary care, which appellate court said is reversible error.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Vail. Thank you, Mr. Phoebus. We will take the case under advisement.